Talking History. On News Talk.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, we're looking at Hitler's last great throw of the dice as we debate the Battle of the Bulge between December 1944 and January 1945. We'd love you to join our discussion. You can send us a text on 53106, that's for 30 cents, or you can email us talkinghistory@newstalk.com. Last week, we took a fresh look at the life and work of Jane Austen, explored the world of Raphael, and heard about the contribution of Irish women to the First World War in our September book show. And if you want to listen back to this or any of our older shows, just go to our website newstalk.com or wherever you download your podcasts. In tonight's show, we're looking at the Battle of the Bulge, what has been described as one of the touchstone battles of the Second World War. In December 1944, Hitler directed the Ardennes offensive in what became the decisive campaign of the war in northwest Europe. For a time, it looked like the Allied armies had been outflanked and might be divided and pushed backwards. There followed a dramatic confrontation at the crossroads town of Bastogne, where the siege was relieved by the arrival of General George Patton's Third Army. It became the largest battle fought by American troops in the Second World War, and although the Allied campaign was stalled, the German army failed in its objective. The battle has been much represented in fiction, including a 1965 film, The Battle of the Bulge, starring Henry Fonda, Robert Shaw, and Telly Savalas, and it also featured in the miniseries Band of Brothers. And so in tonight's show, we want to explore what happened and assess its significance. And to help me do this, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Dr. Mark Jones lectures in global history at University College Dublin and is an expert on the history of political violence, war and revolution, and his books include Founding Weimar, Violence and the German Revolution of 1918 to 1919. Dr. David Murphy lectures in history at Maynooth University and is an expert on military history, Irish and international, and across many different centuries. And his books include Breaking Point of the French Army, The Nivelle Offensive of 1917. David Turns is Senior Lecturer in Defence Management and Leadership at Cranfield University and is an expert on international humanitarian law, and he has written extensively on the law of armed conflict. Matthew Bila is Director of the Bastogne War Museum and is the author of Ardennes 1944 to 1945. Well, you're all very welcome. And Mark, I might begin with you. And I'll begin with the question of what did Hitler want to achieve with this offensive? And also the fact that it was very much Hitler's offensive.
That's right, Patrick. I think the first thing is we need to put the offensive into context of the military history of the year 1944. As probably most people know, in June of 1944, the Allies land in Normandy. They establish a foothold. In the same month, on the third anniversary of the German invasion of Soviet Union, the Soviets launched a massive counteroffensive. And so from really the end of June onwards, on both the eastern and western fronts, the Germans are moving backwards. In July, then you have the bomb plot, 20th of July, when Count von Stauffenberg tries to blow up Hitler in the Wolf's Lair. And this radicalizes Hitler because it provides him with an excuse for why his soldiers have been performing so badly. He starts to think the army leadership is against him. And the Allies continue to advance. By August, you know, in the month of August, you get the Warsaw Uprising and you get the liberation of Paris. And by the autumn, most of France is liberated. And as a consequence of that, you know, the Allied commanders in the West start to think Germany's not really capable of launching a new offensive. The German army, however, as we know from the course of 1943 and 1944, is very, very good at picking itself up. The collapse that people expect to happen in the late autumn and early winter doesn't happen. It picks itself up and it gets itself into a position where it can dig in and fight on through the winter. And this is the point when Hitler in November starts thinking about an offensive as being the way out of this problem. And this really, at the heart of this decision making, is the idea of, Nazism has always been aggressive. Hitler's always been a gambler. It's always been about taking the fight to the enemy. And so, you know, the idea that they can be reactive and respond to the Americans and the British in the West, it just goes against the very essence of Hitler's rule and Hitler's ideas about what his regime is about. And so he first says it to a small circle of senior commanders in November, and they say they tell him the plan has no chance of success, but he sticks to it. And then on the 12th and 13th of December 1944, he brings together a wider circle of generals, and he gives them a long speech for which we have a very good record. And the first half of the speech, he starts actually with a history of Germany that goes back to the 19th century, and he talks about his regime as being the continuation of the wars of 1866, 1870. He justifies Nazi foreign policy since 1933, since he's became dictator of Germany, and he justifies why the war happens. And he then goes on in the second half of the speech to say why they need to launch the offensive in the West. And that puts the generals in a place where just weeks after the purges of the army, that are still even ongoing following the bomb plot, they can't really at that point refuse to carry out his operation. That's the nature of the power dynamic within Nazi Germany at this time, at the decision-making level. And so any critical thinking that may have made these army generals say this isn't going to work, that's thrown out of out the window, and instead the offensive, as Hitler wishes it, takes place just a few days later.
And is there a sense, Mark, that Hitler thinks that he's some kind of military genius and that he knows better than the generals? Or is it just that he's lost faith in them completely and he thinks that this is worth a desperate gamble?
He thinks he's a military genius, and a lot of much more importantly than why he thinks he's a military genius, a lot of people in Germany think he's a military genius. If we think of the First World War, you know, 4 years, Germany invades France, they never get to Paris, 2 million German dead. In the summer of 1940, after 6 weeks, the invasion of France is over and France has capitulated, and Hitler takes the credit for that. And so that, and that point in time after the fall of France is really the high point of Hitler's popularity. And that allows him to build this myth of Hitler, the leader, the Führer myth that's referred to in a lot of literature. And it continues until the very end of the war. And one of the things that Hitler does, if you think of the photographs of Hitler during the Second World War, you see him so often over maps of the front, pushing his ideas forward. And a lot of people but within the military and in the wider society do see him as this kind of great military leader. And that actually feeds into why soldiers fight later on, because people believe that, you know, the Führer has given us this offensive. It's his Christmas present, because the battle takes place at Christmas. And when it's initially successful, you know, the Schnapps ration in Berlin is drunk in a night because the news hits that the Germans are doing okay. And people believe this is Hitler's, he hasn't lost that magic touch that he always had, and Hitler will rescue us from this situation. It is, of course, nonsense, but in an extreme situation, people will believe what they want to believe.
David Murphy, it's very interesting listening to what's going on in Hitler's mind and the great plan here. Can we talk more about the German plan and strategy? Because there does seem to be a certain logic to the offensive, because there's a hope that you'll catch the Americans by surprise and that you might be able to push on to Antwerp and so on. But when it comes down to the reality, though, it seems crazy, and that this is something the German generals realised, because the terrain didn't really allow the kind of rapid advance that Hitler was expecting.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's worth backing up just a wee bit to have a look at the wider context as well that's emerging across France, Belgium at this time. I mean, I think a lot of people, we will look at the Battle of the Bulge as a crazy gamble. I think, you know, to a certain extent, they're looking at the situation. We have had Allied Normandy landings, obviously, followed by Operation Dragoon, landings in the south of France. But by this stage, by late 44, there's a certain amount of grit in the system, so to speak. I mean, the Allies are starting to look increasingly overstretched logistically in terms of basically moving people and materiel to the front. You also look, I mean, there is a dissonance between the Allied commanders, particularly Bradley and Montgomery, and the Germans are aware of this. And also you have to kind of, the wider military context of this, I mean, in September, we have Market Garden, which is a humiliating failure for the Allied, for the Allies. And around the same time, we've got the launch of the offensive into the Hürtgen Forest in middle of September. We'll run on until 1945. And that is grinding down, it's grinding American troops up, and they're getting no success. And also we can look further down, the Lorraine Offensive and the Metz Offensive with Patton's Third Army, and they are finding themselves in a stalemate situation. So, I mean, that is the context. And Hitler stands back and looks at this. and sees an opportunity. And we have to think of what his objective in this as well. I mean, he knows he has enough probably for one more offensive. If he launches in the east, it will just disappear on the eastern front. It will be of no effort. But if he can repeat some of his 1940 successes, and what we see here is he's trying to return to that playbook that had emerged in 1940 and do some of the same stuff again. If he can, the army can push to the coast of Antwerp. If it can cut off a group of armies to the north of that, American and Canadian and British troops, and destroy those four armies, you may get the Allies to come to the peace table. So he's not necessarily looking for a victory per se. He's looking to stop the clock in the West. And in doing that, that will give him time to bring on the wonder weapons, et cetera, et cetera. So I think when we look back in hindsight, we can see that it's all kind of crazy. But at the same time, there is a certain logic to his system there. And even some of the stuff, the route through the Ardennes, they'd used that successfully in 1940. It doesn't work for them this time. Some of the operational stuff, some of the like the false flag operations we see with Skorzeny, they had run those in the Netherlands and Belgium and France in 1940, ran them well. They don't work this time. Even the use of paratroopers in Operation Strasser, they had quite spectacular successes with paratroopers, but it doesn't work this time. So he's returning to this kind of menu in this hope that he will achieve success as well. There is dissent within the German, obviously there is dissent within the German High Command, and the two senior leaders in this von Rundstedt and Walter Model will both come to him with a smaller plan, what's known as the small solution, and will offer that as, look, we will not try and get across the Maas River, the Maas River as it's known in the Netherlands. We will actually just do something a bit more modest, and hopefully it will have an effect. But he insists on going with the big plan. And that's really where it comes all unhinged.
And David, when we cover battles on the show, it's usually named after a nearby town or something like Waterloo or Gettysburg or so on. But how does this one get the name Battle of the Bulge?
Well, because it creates, if you look at a map, it creates a bulge into the Allied lines. So that's essentially it. And it is called different things. I mean, in popular German kind of histories, it would be called the von Rundstedt Offensive or the Ardennes Offensive. But most people will come back to the idea of the Battle of the Bulge. It's all a question if anybody's listening, you want to pull up a map on the on their internet, they will actually see that protrusion into the lines. And that's where it becomes... It's a bulge. It's a salient.
And you mentioned Otto Skorzeny there, and he's someone we've covered on the show. There was a recent biography of him. He's someone who had an extraordinary career and ended up in Ireland in his later years.
Yes, I mean, he is an incredible man to follow. But you know, he busts out. He's on trial for war crimes back at the old Dachau prison. He busts out. In American uniform himself, and some former comrades get American uniforms and get out of the prison. But between, I think, 57 and 59, he lives out in Kildare and tries to be a sheep farmer. And there's some fascinating, again, you can find this online. He was interviewed. There's film footage of him driving around his Massey Ferguson tractor, et cetera, et cetera. That's all kind of bizarre to see this. The most dangerous man in Europe on a tractor in Kildare.
Very good. David Turns, you're an expert on the law of armed conflict and international humanitarian law. And I'm interested in something that David Murphy alluded to there about some of the tactics that were used, because that's something that's always been suggested, that the dirty tactics were used by the Germans in having soldiers wearing American uniforms, their own soldiers, and trying to swap road signs and things like that. Were dirty tactics used, and were they illegal by the North forms of international law at the time?
I think a lot depends on the answer to that question on what your perspective is. I mean, it's dirty tactics if somebody uses it against you, but it's not necessarily dirty tactics if you use it against the other side. The problem from a legal point of view, and this was law that was quite well known at the time, it was well understood in the armies of both sides, was the question of the use of the enemy's uniform. Now, there was a provision in the law that dated from, in its original form, dated from 1899. There had been some earlier formulations of it going back to the 1870s, and one very early formulation actually used in the American Civil War in the 1860s, which basically said you're not supposed to make an improper use of the enemy's uniform. And the big question was, what is an improper use? So on the one hand, you've got this idea that combatants always have to distinguish themselves. They always have to be able to distinguish themselves from the civilian population, and they have to be able to distinguish themselves from the enemy, because that's a central part of the law of war provisions that enable sparing the civilian population from the worst effects of hostilities. So soldiers are expected to wear their proper uniform, because that way you can tell them from the civilian population, and you can also distinguish them from the enemy forces. However, the use of the uniform of the other side is actually a practice that goes back at least 150 years in modern warfare, if not before that. There were cases in the American Civil War when entire formations of the Confederate Army, for example, were actually dressed in federal uniforms. And that was basically because they did not have the supplies of the normal Confederate uniforms, which of course were gray. The Confederacy had run out of the so-called butternut colouring that was used for the uniforms. And so they would simply take pilfered uniforms from the Federal Army and dress as Federal soldiers. In the Boer War in South Africa, again, substantial formations of Boer commandos basically pilfered bits and pieces of uniforms from British soldiers that they killed or captured in the veldt in South Africa and wore them. So there was quite a long history of this. The question was, when was it actually improper? And when was it tolerated? Because there is also a provision in the law, which again was well known at the time of World War II, which said that it is permitted to deceive the enemy. So on the one hand, it's forbidden to wear the enemy's uniform if it's improper, but on the other hand, it's permitted to deceive the enemy. So if you're wearing the enemy's uniform, which is forbidden, but you're deceiving the enemy, which is allowed, which one is correct?
Very interesting. And in terms of the suggestion that road signs were reversed and swapped and so on to trick the American troops and make them think that the Germans were coming from a different angle, was that true and how legal was that?
Oh, that's absolutely true. There were many instances of road signs being reversed, so pointing to towns in the wrong direction, effectively. Not only reversing road signs, but also tampering with the signs of minefields. So putting up a sign, erecting a sign on the edge of a field to make it look as though it was a minefield so people wouldn't go there when actually there was nothing there. Or conversely, removing minefield warning signs when actually there was a minefield there. So there was quite a lot of that. Also, there were instances of deviations being set up. So the Germans set up roadblocks, effectively, with deviation signs in order to send American troops in the wrong direction. And it was actually quite effective. They sent there's at least one recorded instance in the Battle of the Bulge where they sent an entire regiment of U.S. Troops in completely the wrong direction. And the regiment apparently got lost for several days and was just wandering around behind the American lines, not knowing where they were going and not doing anything useful. They also were able to divert forces and send them a long way around so that they took longer to reach the battlefield. So it was quite effective. And as for whether it was legal, yes, I would say perfectly. Deceiving the enemy in that way, so we're not talking about the improper use of uniforms now, we're just talking about basic deception, that's perfectly lawful. That falls within what the law calls, we use a French term for it for reasons lost in the mists of historical legal development in the 19th century, we call it ruse de guerre, tricks of war. And deceiving the enemy in that way is a ruse de guerre, making the enemy think that he should be in one place when actually you want him to be in another place, deceiving him as to the strength of your forces, sending him in the wrong direction. That was all considered perfectly lawful at the time and is considered perfectly lawful today.
Matthew, I'm wondering how devastating was the Battle of the Bulge for the region and for the local populations? Do we know how many, how bad it was in terms of civilian casualties?
Yes, so the region of the Ardennes was particularly hit by the combat and the bombing. After the battle, many villages were in ruins. Houses and infrastructure destroyed, dead bodies and carcasses of animals laid in the streets, in the fields or in the forest, wrecks of vehicle, etc. Civilians came easily across all sorts of military equipment spread all over the battlefields. but also mines and explosives, which was especially dangerous for the population, of course. The devastated region was literally cut off from the rest of the country because of the destruction of the road network and rail tracks. In total, there were 220 kilometers of road destroyed, and almost 22,000 houses had suffered damage. About the casualties among the civilians, there is about 3,000 civilians killed during the battle. But we know also that many other people lost their life after the battle because of different reasons, like, for instance, lack of medical assistance or mines and explosives. For instance, in the perimeter of Bastogne, 40 people lost their life during the first month of 1945. So, still in the summer of 1945. So when the battle was over, many people still lost their life because of the mines and explosives. So yes, it was a devastated region, of course.
And of course, there was heavy aerial bombardment as well, and that was quite extensive.
Yes, many bombings, aerial bombings. Many villages suffers from chilling, but also aerial bombings, as I said. The German bombed some cities. They used, for the anecdote, the first jet bomber, Aredo 234, to bomb the small towns of Neuchâtel and Libramont. They bombed also the city of Bastogne, but those German operation, aerial operation, were not the main. I mean, most of the aircraft flying over the Ardennes during the winter 44-45 were Allied planes. So definitely the Allies led a lot of aerial operation. So from December 23rd, when the weather was clear, when the sky was clear, the powerful Allied aviation attacked targets on the ground. Every truck, tanks, concentration of troops spotted by the Allied aviators were attacked. The German supply lines were also heavily attacked. So behind the front line, small towns like, for instance, Saint-Vit, Oufalise, La Roche and Malmedy were completely wiped out by carpet bombing. General Patton himself was appalled by the vision of Oufalise when he discovered the ruins of the small city in January 1945. He wrote in his diary that he never saw anything like this in this war. So yes, the villages, the localities in the Ardennes were really, some of them were completely destroyed by those bombings. It was really bad case for those cities. The case of Malmedy, for instance, is very specific and very very sad by the same way, because this city close to the German border, so it's a Belgian city close to the German border, it was bombed three times in a row by the U.S. aircraft, despite the fact that Malmedy stays already in American hands. So the U.S. airplane made a confusion with the German town, and this sad mistake caused collateral damage among the civilian population, but also among the U.S. soldiers who were stationed in Malmedy. So yes, this is a specific case of Malmedy, but many other villages, cities were bombed.
Okay, well, tonight we are debating the Battle of the Bulge. We're going to take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll explore what happened during the course of the battle, why the Germans were fighting, and how many people were killed. So stay with us here on News Talk.
Talking history.
on News Talk. Well, welcome back to Talking History as we debate the Battle of the Bulge. I'm joined by Dr. Mark Jones of UCD, Dr. David Murphy of Maynooth University, David Turns of Cranfield University, and Matthew Biela of the Bastogne War Museum. Mark, do we know why the Germans, or how the German soldiers were feeling during this? Were they exhausted by the war and looking for, hoping for a way out, or were they still victims of the Nazi ideology and believing that this was the right thing and that they must carry on and fight and that there was no alternative?
That's a great question, and it's a controversial question in Germany. I think, first of all, the Wehrmacht is a conscript army, and so it reflects German society as a whole in late 1944-45. So you'll have voices in that army who are people who are, you know, sources like letters, where it's very clear that the soldiers who write them want to go home. They think the war is lost. You then have another explanation, which is that Nazi Germany is extremely brutal towards its own soldiers. Desertion is a crime. Desertion will be punished. There's even a threat at one point that family members will be shot, and the document in place it specifically states the wife of a soldier who's caught deserting will be shot. Whether that's actually implemented or not is harder to measure. So you have to say this. It's difficult to measure how freely this army could think, but there's a general argument in a lot of literature, which I find quite convincing, which is that Germany is obviously, soldiers are fighting to try and protect their homeland from invasion. They don't want the Americans and the British to enter in the West, and they certainly don't want the Russians to enter in the East. And then we have to draw those statistics we heard, which are obviously about real people, so we shouldn't just write them off as statistics, that we heard before the break. And we have to put them into the context of the bigger war. And, I think it's a frightening statistic, 8.6 million civilians estimated to have died under Nazi occupation in Europe. The overwhelming majority of those are in the East. 150 to 180,000 people are killed in the Warsaw Uprising, which takes place in August, September 1944. And so how do we bring that Eastern European story to bear on what's happening on the Western Front in late 1944 and early 1945, and why the German army is fighting? And the crucial point here is that, the Holocaust by this stage in the war is in the past. Most of Europe's Jews are alive at the start of 1942. By the end of 1942, that's no longer the case. And one historian, Nicholas Stargardt, has argued recently in a book called The German War about a way of understanding this as having become something of a shared secret in Germany by late 1944-45. It's something that a large number of people know have happened, but they don't want to speak openly about it, or they only want to speak about it when a drink has been taken, in whispers. And the argument that he puts forward, and which I find quite convincing, is that by this stage in the war, there is the fear that what they have done to their enemies will be done to them, and so they must keep fighting for this reason. And you'll find that as a part of the explanation of why the Wehrmacht, why Wehrmacht soldiers continue to fight. Others still believe in the myth of Hitler, the leader that we were talking about earlier. They want to believe in it. And then of course there's another explanation, which is that men don't fight for the ideas as much as they fight for their comrades, for the band of brothers, for those who are in the trenches with them. And so those arguments are put forward and argued by historians a lot, and it's open to debate as to, to what extent they are going forward because it's a set of Nazi ideas, and to what extent it's simply a reflection of men wanting to protect their homeland. And to put it, to maybe formulate the question in a very in a polemical kind of way, is, would the American soldiers have behaved differently if they were on the German side of the lines, and would the German soldiers have behaved differently if they were on the American side of the lines? And we'll come to the atrocities that both sides commit during the battle. We'll come to prisoner executions. Both sides commit prisoner executions, and so one could argue, and some German historians do argue, that this is a reflection of the fact that these men are responding to the circumstances of a very brutal battle taking place, in woods in winter. Mortar fire is what's caused most soldierly deaths in this battle. You know, there are a lot of bodies lying around. It's very obvious that people are being brutalized by these conditions, and so you can argue that they just respond to those conditions, and that's what pushes them over the line to kill prisoners and to engage in atrocities. I would argue on the German side, however, that there's more penetration of the Nazi ideas into the German army than a lot of historians are willing to give, willing to admit.
Very interesting. David Murphy, what went wrong with the offensive? It seems to have been based on the idea that the Americans would be caught by surprise and wouldn't be able to reinforce in time, but that didn't prove to be the case. And is that what went wrong, that there were misjudgments about the speed of, say, George Patton coming to the rescue? Or can you talk us through maybe what actually happened with the Battle of the Bulge?
Sure. I mean, there are a number of factors that come into play. It is really one of those plans, a bit like the Market Garden plan, actually, on the Allied side, that if everything goes according to plan, we'll probably succeed. But there's no room in the plan for slippage. And they really don't have the materiel to engage in any kind of contingency plan, so to speak. There's a couple of different factors. I mean, you crunch the raw numbers. I mean, when you look at the start of this, the Germans have, say, a 2-to-1 superiority over the Americans at the point of the offensive. They know that those American troops, where they're going to let the heaviest weight of their offensive fall, are pretty inexperienced and are pretty raw. But what will actually happen over time is that by in around Christmas, 24th, 25th of December, the Germans have reached their maximum in terms of manpower, which is about 450,000. But the Allies will hit that, surpass that, and go up to 750,000 troops in the area. So if the initial phase doesn't create the breakthrough and win, what will actually happen is that the Allies will eventually be able to reinforce with manpower and build up. So that is a factor. There's also the pivot, obviously, that is quite, I suppose, quite famous, that Patton can pivot his army from the Lorraine front, pivot it northwards and come to the rescue, pick up the basically end the siege at Bastogne. So that's a major factor. But obviously, as well, there's the whole supply issue. There's a huge effort. I mean, supplies for the Allies have been really difficult across the whole theater, eastern operations for 1944. But they really upped their game to get material by truck, by air power, by parachuting material in, by landing it by glider, to kind of sustain the besieged areas in around Bastogne and the actions around St. Vith, et cetera, et cetera. So all of these factors come into play. And then I suppose at the end of the day as well, there's some very dogged fighting, and you can identify particular units and you can identify particular locations. But across the Allied front, there are certain troops that will decide to dig in and not budge, and they really blunt the German spearhead. And there's a very lonely crossroads called, I think it's Miller's Crossroads, over to the east of Bastogne. And essentially a defensive action develops there by one captain of artillery gathers some odd stragglers around him and digs in there for a number of 2 or 3 days. And that takes the momentum out of the German spearhead in that location. And you have similar actions repeated up and down up and down the front. And it just blunts the Germans. And it means that they don't get to push on through. And then even some of this, I mean, a lot is made, they do capture a lot of petrol during this. All in all, about 50,000 gallons, I think, of petrol is actually captured by the Germans. But even that, when you add the captured petrol and when you add the petrol they had beforehand, they had about, 50% of the requirement to get them to Antwerp. So when you crunch the numbers, you could actually say this is just never going to happen, never going to happen. That's the way it fritters out. I mean, and then in early January, they will try 2 more counteroffensives. One is an air offensive to try and take the pressure off. Another is a land offensive. But they're really at that stage, they're in delaying actions, trying to stop further kind of Allied momentum throughout the winter in the hope that they can recollect themselves and set down to more static defences in the Siegfried Line.
And David, we heard Mark mention various atrocities on both sides. In terms of the war crimes, how bad did things get during the course of the battle?
Yeah, well, I think throughout the summer of 1944, and you can see this in various actions and across France, Belgium, Netherlands, there are cases of prisoner execution. We know that. And it tends to be, you know, one or two people surrender, and for whatever reason, their captors decide to shoot out of hand. And that happens across that front throughout 1944. We have a couple of particular examples, particularly bad ones in this offensive. The most famous one is obviously Malmedy, where you have a group of about 120 American troops gathered in a kind of like a location beside the road. There's a memorial at this location today, if anyone's in that area. And they're being held by Germans. And it's not exactly sure how this actually starts. But anyway, the Germans begin shooting and they kill 84 of them. Okay, there's another location near Bastogne, Verith, where 11 black troops, black American troops, are captured by an SS unit. And they are actually, we know that they were actually tortured before they were executed. So we've a couple of instances like that from the German side. And then also near Bastogne, later on in this offensive, a group of about 60 German POWs are executed by Americans. By that stage, obviously, a revenge killing and things are getting very much out of hand. So we've got a couple of very bloody incidents on both sides of the lines in this operation. I suppose Malmedy gets the most attention. And later, there's specific war crimes and there's the war crimes trial. And there's select committee hearings and whatever else in the States about that particular incident. But it's all part of a hardening across the front. These things, obviously, on the Eastern Front and the Russian Front, happen on a daily basis. We try and think that that Allied troops would not be associated with this, but there's a German POW execution as well.
Very good. Matthew, I might bring you in as well, because you met the granddaughter of one of the survivors of one of the massacres.
Yes, it's the massacre of six civilians that happened in the region of Oufalise. In general, during the whole Battle of the Bulge, there were about 250 civilians that were massacred by Nazi troops. Some of them, it was committed by SS troops in the northern flank in the region of Stavelot, for instance. It was really to terrorize in a certain way, to revenge, because the Nazi troops considered many civilians as resistance fighters or former resistance fighters, which was sometimes true but sometimes fake as well. And so in the region of Oufalise, those 6 men were arrested on 23rd of December 1944. They were questioned about their activities in the resistance during the occupation of the country. They're refusing to tell anything. They were beaten. And then the day after, on 24th of December, they were taken to a wood to be executed. And so one of the 6 men, 30 years old, Eudor Wenquin, succeed to escape miraculously after knocking his murderer on the face. At the moment of firing the revolver, the revolver of the murderer was got jammed, and so it was the last chance, last luck for Mr. Wenquin to escape. But the bodies of the 5 other men were discovered after the battle in the woods, all of them with a bullet hole in the neck. And so I know the granddaughter of this person, And still today, for this young lady, she's not 30 years old, something like 28 or 27, I can't remind me exactly, can't remember exactly, but every year on the Christmas Eve, she goes with the all the members of the families of the people who were executed in the wood, where there is now a small monument to hold a small commemoration to remember what happened in that wood. So she explained me that it's still important for her to get there every year. So yes, definitely those massacres among the civilians population are still very important in the local memories. Yes, this it's something interesting to see. Yes, to realize that 75 years ago there are still some memories very important about those battles among the population as well.
Okay, well, we're going to take another quick break now, but when we come back, we'll explore the legacy of the battle and how it is remembered today. So stay with us here on News Talk.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History as we debate the Battle of the Bulge. I'm joined by Mark Jones, David Murphy, David Turns, and Matthew Biela. David Turns, can I ask you about growing up in Belgium in the 1970s? How was the Battle of the Bulge commemorated when you were growing up, and where do you think it, or where do you think it features in people's memory now?
Okay, well, as far as I was concerned, when I was growing up there in the 1970s, I lived in Brussels, and I remember visiting the battlefields in the Ardennes. Went there with my parents. We got in the car and drove. It's about 2.5 hours from Brussels on the motorway. And there's a very big, impressive museum and memorial complex there. There are monuments. It is something that as a specific battle, I think the colleague from Belgium mentioned already that it obviously had a very, very profound effect on the local civilian population and in the living memory of that area. But certainly as far as the rest of Belgium was concerned also, the war was only about 35 years finished by that time, or even less. And the memory of the war generally and the occupation generally and the Battle of the Bulge as part of that was very, very much a living memory in Belgium. And it was quite simply the fact that when I lived there at that time, people did, if I can put it very bluntly, people did not like Germans very much. I mean, there was this popular memory that Belgium had been invaded and occupied not once, but twice within the space of 20 odd years by the Germans. Many atrocities had been committed. We heard about those a little bit earlier in the program. Many civilians had been executed. People had been arrested and thrown in jail. They'd been tortured and so on. And that's without even thinking about the battles that had taken place on Belgian territory, which had caused a great deal of devastation, as we've already heard. So there was this very resentful feel, I think, still in the 1970s. The Battle of the Bulge, as I remember, was commemorated every year around the anniversary in December. There was usually a commemorative parade of some kind. There were local ceremonies in the areas of the Ardennes, particularly focusing on Bastogne, where the battle would be commemorated. Now, as for the position today, I think, as part of generational change, of course, memories have moved on a bit. I think, obviously, the memory is still there. The memorials are still there. And certainly those who come from families that were directly affected by the fighting, they haven't forgotten, obviously. But I think in a more general sense, people are moving on a little bit, and there isn't that same resentment of the Germans that existed in the 1970s. There isn't that generalized feeling that, you know, they were the bad guys who were occupying Belgium and they committed lots of atrocities. And the Americans were hailed as you know, the liberators in that part of Belgium. In Brussels, where I lived, it was the British who were hailed as liberators. And, you know, that was still very much the living memory at that time. But I think those memories have faded now. And of course, as the process of countries working together much more in Europe has progressed over the last few decades, I think that it's less of a live memory and something that is more relegated to history. And of course, the generation who lived through it are now dying out. There are fewer people around, quite simply, who were alive at the time and who remember what happened.
Okay, well, we're almost out of time, but I might leave the final word to you, David Murphy. The significance of the battle?
I think it had huge media attention at the time because there were actually quite a lot of correspondence there at the time. So it is a battle that was very well covered in word and also in film. I think the significance of it, such a big battle so close to the end of the war, initiated by the Germans, was a huge military and also a culture shock across Europe, across the Allied nations. And also, I think it is quite often put forward as the reason that the Allied campaign doesn't go as well in 1945, that they don't get to Berlin in time. Now, the truth of that has to be debated again. But, it is always put forward as this kind of moment where the Allied plan seems to be going a certain direction, albeit with some difficulties, and then it stopped. And they do not recover from that as much as they would like to have done, and liberated as much as Europe and got the war over as quickly as possible because of the Battle of the Bulge.
Okay, well, a good note on which to leave our discussion. My thanks to my brilliant panel of experts, Dr. Mark Jones of UCD, Dr. David Murphy of Maynooth University, David Turns of Cranfield University, and Matthew Biela of the wonderful Bastogne War Museum, and that comes very highly recommended. Well, that is the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks for everyone who put tonight's show together, Susan Calf, my producer, and Jodo Cardosa on sound. Next week, we'll be discussing the birth of the border, the development of the stealth fighter and bomber, and the life and world of Vincent van Gogh in our second monthly book show. So join us next week on News Talk. We've been talking history. Good night.
Talking history on News Talk.